Section C. We next determine whether the Act imposes an undue burden as a facial matter because its restrictions on second trimester abortions are too broad. A review of the statutory text discloses the limits of its reach. The Act prohibits intact D&E, and notwithstanding respondents' arguments, it does not prohibit the D&E procedure in which the fetus is removed in parts. Section 1. The Act prohibits a doctor from intentionally performing an intact D&E. The dual prohibitions of the Act, both of which are necessary for criminal liability, correspond with the steps generally undertaken during this type of procedure. First, a doctor delivers the fetus until its head lodges in the cervix, which is usually past the anatomical landmark for a breech presentation. Second, the doctor proceeds to pierce the fetal skull with scissors or to crush it with forceps. This step satisfies the overt act requirement because it kills the fetus and is distinct from delivery. The Act's intent requirements, however, limit its reach to those physicians who carry out the intact D&E after intending to undertake both steps at the outset. The Act excludes most D&Es in which the fetus is removed in pieces, not intact. If the doctor intends to remove the fetus in parts from the outset, the doctor will not have the requisite intent to incur criminal liability. A doctor performing a standard D&E procedure can often take about 10 to 15 passes through the uterus to remove the entire fetus. Removing the fetus in this manner does not violate the Act because the doctor will not have delivered the living fetus to one of the anatomical landmarks or committed an additional overt act that kills the fetus after partial delivery. A comparison of the Act with the Nebraska statute struck down in Stenberg confirms this point. The statute in Stenberg prohibited deliberately and intentionally delivering into the vagina a living unborn child or a substantial portion thereof for the purpose of performing a procedure that the person performing such procedure knows will kill the unborn child and does kill the unborn child. The court concluded that this statute encompassed D&E because D&E will often involve a physician pulling a substantial portion of a still living fetus, say an arm or a leg, into the vagina prior to the death of the fetus. The court also rejected the limiting interpretation urged by Nebraska's Attorney General that the statute's reference to a procedure that kills the unborn child was to a distinct procedure, not to the abortion procedure as a whole. Congress, it is apparent, responded to these concerns because the Act departs in material ways from the statute in Stenberg. It adopts the phrase, delivers a living fetus, instead of delivering a living unborn child or a substantial portion thereof. The Act's language, unlike the statute in Stenberg, expresses the usual meaning of deliver when used in connection with fetus, namely extraction of an entire fetus rather than removal of fetal pieces. The Act thus displaces the interpretation of delivering dictated by the Nebraska statute's reference to a substantial portion of the fetus. In interpreting statutory texts, courts use the ordinary meaning of terms unless context requires a different result. Here, unlike in Stenberg, the language does not require a departure from the ordinary meaning. D&E does not involve the delivery of a fetus because it requires the removal of fetal parts that are ripped from the fetus as they are pulled through the cervix. The identification of specific anatomical landmarks to which the fetus must be partially delivered also differentiates the Act from the statute at issue in Stenberg. The court in Stenberg interpreted substantial portion of the fetus to include an arm or a leg. The Act's anatomical landmarks, by contrast, clarify that the removal of a small portion of the fetus is not prohibited. The landmarks also require the fetus to be delivered so that it is partially outside the body of the mother. To come within the ambit of the Nebraska statute, on the other hand, a substantial portion of the fetus only had to be delivered into the vagina. No part of the fetus had to be outside the body of the mother before a doctor could face criminal sanctions. By adding an overt act requirement, Congress sought further to meet the court's objections to the state statute considered in Stenberg. The Act makes the distinction between the Nebraska statute failed to draw, but the Nebraska Attorney General advanced, by differentiating between the overall partial birth abortion and the distinct overt act that kills the fetus. The fatal overt act must occur after delivery to an anatomical landmark, and it must be something other than the completion of delivery. This distinction matters because, unlike intact D&E, Standard D&E does not involve a delivery followed by a fatal act. The canon of constitutional avoidance, finally, extinguishes any lingering doubt as to whether the act covers the prototypical D&D procedure. The elementary rule is that every reasonable construction must be resorted to in order to save a statute from unconstitutionality. It is true this long-standing maxim of statutory interpretation has in the past fallen by the wayside when the court confronted a statute regulating abortion. The court at times employed an antagonistic canon of construction under which, in cases involving abortion, a permissible reading of a statute was to be avoided at all costs. Casey put this novel statutory approach to rest. Stenberg need not be interpreted to have revived it. We read that decision instead to stand for the uncontroversial proposition that the canon of constitutional avoidance does not apply if a statute is not genuinely susceptible to two constructions. In Stenberg, the court found the statute covered D&E. Here, by contrast, interpreting the act so that it does not prohibit standard D&E is the most reasonable reading and understanding of its terms. Section 2. Contrary arguments by the respondents are unavailing. Respondents look to situations that might arise during D&E, situations not examined in Stenberg. They contend, relying on the testimony of numerous abortion doctors, that D&E may result in the delivery of a living fetus beyond the act's anatomical landmarks in a significant fraction of cases. This is so, respondents say, because doctors cannot predict the amount the cervix will dilate before the abortion procedure. It might dilate to a degree that the fetus will be removed largely intact. To complete the abortion, doctors will commit an overt act that kills the partially delivered fetus. Respondents thus posit that any D&D has the potential to violate the act and that a physician will not know beforehand whether the abortion will proceed in a prohibited manner. This reasoning, however, does not take account of the act's intent requirements, which preclude liability from attaching to an accidental intact D&E. If a doctor's intent at the outset is to perform a D&D in which the fetus would not be delivered to either of the act's anatomical landmarks, but the fetus nevertheless is delivered past one of those points, the requisite and prohibited scienter is not present. When a doctor in that situation completes an abortion by performing an intact D&E, the doctor does not violate the act. It is true that intent to cause a result may sometimes be inferred if a person knows that the result is practically certain to follow from his conduct. Yet abortion doctors intending at the outset to perform a standard D&E procedure will not know that a prohibited abortion is practically certain to follow from their conduct. A fetus is only delivered largely intact in a small fraction of the overall number of D&E abortions. The evidence also supports a legislative determination that an intact delivery is almost always a conscious choice rather than a happenstance. Doctors, for example, may remove the fetus in a manner that will increase the chances of an intact delivery. And intact D&E is usually described as involving some manner of serial dilation. Doctors who do not seek to obtain this serial dilation perform an intact D&E on far fewer occasions. This evidence belies any claim that a standard D&E cannot be performed without intending or foreseeing an intact D&E. Many doctors who testified on behalf of respondents and who objected to the act do not perform an intact D&E by accident. On the contrary, they begin every D&D abortion with the objective of removing the fetus as intact as possible. This does not prove, as respondents suggest, that every D&E might violate the act and that the act therefore imposes an undue burden. It demonstrates only that those doctors who intend to perform a D&E that would involve delivery of a living fetus to one of the act's anatomical landmarks must adjust their conduct to the law by not attempting to deliver the fetus to either of those points. Respondents have not shown that requiring doctors to intend dismemberment before delivery to an anatomical landmark will prohibit the vast majority of D&D abortions. The act, then, cannot be held invalid on its face on those grounds. Part 4. Under the principles accepted as controlling here, the act as we have interpreted it would be unconstitutional if its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. The abortions affected by the Act's regulations take place both pre-viability and post-viability, So the quoted language and the undue burden analysis it relies upon are inapplicable. The question is whether the Act, measured by its text in this facial attack, imposes a substantial obstacle to late-term but pre-viability abortions. The Act does not on its face impose a substantial obstacle, and we reject this further facial challenge to its validity. Section A. The Act's purposes are set forth in recitals preceding its operative provisions. A description of the prohibited abortion procedure demonstrates the rationale for the congressional enactment. The Act proscribes a method of abortion in which a fetus is killed just inches before completion of the birth process. Congress stated as follows, implicitly approving such a brutal and inhumane procedure by choosing not to prohibit it, will further coarsen society to the humanity of not only newborns, but all vulnerable and innocent human life, making it increasingly difficult to protect such life. The Act expresses respect for the dignity of human life. Congress was concerned, furthermore, with the effects on the medical community and on its reputation caused by the practice of partial birth abortion. The findings in the Act explain, partial birth abortion confuses the medical, legal, and ethical duties of physicians to preserve and promote life, as the physician acts directly against the physical life of a child whom he or she had just delivered, all but the head, out of the womb, in order to end that life. There can be no doubt that the government has an interest in protecting the integrity and ethics of the medical profession. Under our precedents, it is clear the state has a significant role to play in regulating the medical profession. Casey reaffirmed these governmental objectives. The government may use its voice and its regulatory authority to show its profound respect for the life within the woman. A central premise of the opinion was that the court's precedents after Roe had undervalued the state's interest in potential life. The plurality opinion indicated the fact that a law which serves a valid purpose, one not designed to strike at the right itself, has the incidental effect of making it more difficult or more expensive to procure an abortion, cannot be enough to invalidate it. This was not an idle assertion. The three premises of Casey must coexist. The third premise, that the state from the inception of the pregnancy maintains its own regulatory interest in protecting the life of the fetus that may become a child, cannot be set at naught by interpreting Casey's requirement of a health exception so it becomes tantamount to allowing a doctor to choose the abortion method he or she might prefer. Where it has a rational basis to act and it does not impose an undue burden, the state may use its regulatory power to bar certain procedures and substitute others, all in furtherance of its legitimate interests in regulating the medical profession in order to promote respect for life, including life of the unborn. The Act's ban on abortions that involve partial delivery of a living fetus furthers the government's objectives. No one would dispute that for many, D&E is a procedure itself laden with the power to devalue human life. Congress could nonetheless conclude that the type of abortion proscribed by the Act requires specific regulation because it implicates additional ethical and moral concerns that justify a special prohibition. Congress determined that the abortion methods it proscribed had a disturbing similarity to the killing of a newborn infant, and thus it was concerned with drawing a bright line that clearly distinguishes abortion and infanticide. The Court has in the past confirmed the validity of drawing boundaries to prevent certain practices that extinguish life and are close to actions that are condemned. Glucksberg found reasonable the state's fear that permitting assisted suicide will start it down the path of voluntary and perhaps even involuntary euthanasia. Respect for human life finds an ultimate expression in the bond of love the mother has for her child. The Act recognizes this reality as well. Whether to have an abortion requires a difficult and painful moral decision. While we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon, it seems unexceptionable to conclude some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained. Severe depression and loss of esteem can follow. In a decision so fraught with emotional consequence, some doctors may prefer not to disclose precise details of the means that will be used, confining themselves to the required statement of risks the procedure entails. From one standpoint, this ought not to be surprising. Any number of patients facing imminent surgical procedures would prefer not to hear all the details, lest the usual anxiety preceding invasive medical procedures become all the more intense. This is likely the case with the abortion procedures here at issue. It is, however, precisely this lack of information concerning the way in which the fetus will be killed that is of a legitimate concern to the state. States are free to enact laws to provide a reasonable framework for a woman to make a decision that has such a profound and lasting meaning. The state has an interest in ensuring so grave a choice is well informed. It is self-evident that a mother who comes to regret her choice to abort must struggle with grief more anguished and sorrow more profound when she learns only after the event what she once did not know, that she allowed a doctor to pierce the skull and vacuum the fast-developing brain of her unborn child, a child assuming the human form. It is a reasonable inference that a necessary effect of the regulation and the knowledge it conveys will be to encourage some women to carry the infant to full term, thus reducing the absolute number of late-term abortions. The medical profession, furthermore, may find different and less shocking methods to abort the fetus in the second trimester, thereby accommodating legislative demand. The state's interest in respect for life is advanced by the dialogue that better informs the political and legal systems, the medical profession, expectant mothers, and society as a whole of the consequences that follow from a decision to elect a late-term abortion. It is objected that the standard D&E is in some respects as brutal, if not more, than the intact D&E, so that the legislation accomplishes little. What we have already said, however, shows ample justification for the regulation. Partial birth abortion, as defined by the Act, differs from a standard D&E because the former occurs when the fetus is partially outside the mother, to the point of one of the Act's anatomical landmarks. It was reasonable for Congress to think that partial birth abortion, more than standard D&E, undermines the public's perception of the appropriate role of the physician during the delivery process and perverts a process during which life is brought into the world. There would be a flaw in this court's logic and an irony in its jurisprudence were we first to conclude a ban on both D&E and intact D&E was overbroad and then to say it is irrational to ban only intact D&E because that does not proscribe both procedures. In sum, we reject the contention that the congressional purpose of the Act was to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion.